I'm Dhruva Chakravarti, and I'm going to tell you about some semantics that can be inferred for programs written using logs. And I will point out that in contrast to the previous talk, quite a bit of my talk will deal with failure atomicity or durability. And I'll show how these are very relevant semantics for programming with non-volatile memory. So before I dive into the semantics, let me spend a moment trying to understand a couple of durability models. Conventionally, what would happen is if you want durability, you would maintain an in-memory object format and a separate persistent durable format. And from time to time, you take your updated objects, serialize them, and write them out to files or databases. So there is some translation code involved, which involves, and it also involves some efficiency issues. But it turns out that in disk-based systems, this makes a whole lot of sense because of the access differences and the latency differences between memory on one hand and storage on the other. Now, fast forward to emerging systems with new non-volatile memory technologies, such as phase change memory, memristors, and others. And what you get from these new memory technologies are very fast access times, like tens of nanoseconds, and of course, durable memory, and these are accessible using CPU stores and loads. So in that context, does it make sense anymore to maintain these two different formats and have translation code and so on? So at least the question is, at least for some applications, can we just get away maintaining just the in-memory format and have a nice model where your in-memory objects are durable as the program executes? All your updates are potentially instantaneously durable. And that is the model we'll assume for this talk. So how do you program such a system? We are proposing that we use the persistent region abstraction, which has been around at least since the days of persistent programming languages. What it gives you is a named entity in persistent memory. It has at least one root, which kind of provides you the access point for all the data that you have in persistent region. And if as a programmer, if you want your objects or data to be durable, you want to allocate a persistent region and put all of that data in a persistent region. Anything that is not in a persistent region is considered transient. How does a program look like? When you start up, you want to typically either create a persistent region or find one to understand if there is already some data that you can reuse. You get to the root and check whether there is some data that already exists. And if they do, you have to write some kind of restart code, which essentially consists of getting your application ready to deal with existing data, and usually involves creating and populating transient data based on the existing persistent data. And if there is no existing data, then you just program as if you're writing from scratch. And then you go maybe adding new data to your persistent region. So the idea here is that you have potentially reusable data in your persistent region. So it's all about reusability. But then the question arises, what happens if your program crashes in the middle? How do you maintain all the invariants that you have in your program? Now, it turns out that when you look at programs using logs, it's not even clear what those invariants are. And the primary reasons are that there is no explicit association between shared datum and the protecting log. So you don't know where your updates start and where they end. And the other reason is that log acquires can be arbitrarily nested, so there is very little structure to the updates that happen in this kind of program. Let's take a look at an example to understand some of the issues. On a time scale, let's consider two threads. T1 first acquires a log, then enters a nested critical section and continues. So at this point, a log is held by T1. So let's try to understand what possibly are the consistent points as far as just T1 is concerned. I've marked C1 to C4, C2, C3, C4 are program points at which at least one lock is held. So typically what happens if you're holding a lock, you are most likely modifying or updating some data structure. So in the midst of updates, so potentially your data is in an inconsistent state. So you clearly don't want C2, C3, C4 to be your consistent state. So as far as just T1 is concerned, it's likely that C1 is only the consistent state. Let's consider thread 2 now. It enters a critical section, exits it, and then enters and exits another critical section. Now, again, showing the consistent points here, as far as just T2 is concerned, I've excluded the ones within critical sections. So C5, C6, C7 are the possible consistent points outside critical sections. Now, what happens if there is a crash in the middle? And mind you, there is a potential dependence or data flow between from T1 to T2. In T2, in the second critical section, it may have read data from C3 in T1. So the question is, does an arbitrary composition of consistent sections across threads give you a program-wide globally consistent state? And you'll see that it does not. For example, if you try to compose C7 and C1, C7 has the changes made in C3, but C1 does not. So the contributions that we make here are try to give you globally consistent states at intermediate program points in a log-based program, so that if the program crashes and you're operating on non-volatile memory, on recovery, you can get back to a consistent state which you saw very close to where the crash occurred, so that you lose as little computation as possible. And we're able to do this in spite of arbitrary lock nesting. We don't need any additional annotations from the programmer. The paper has some optimizations, which I don't think I'll have time to get into here, and we give you an initial idea of some overheads of such a system. So leading from the example that I showed you, our first observation is that program points at which no locks are held are thread consistent, meaning that from the standpoint of that particular thread, that the updates made in that thread are consistent. And basically, we are using critical sections as indicators of consistent states. But this means that you'll have to handle special synchronization. And if you're dealing with a serial program, then the question is, where are the indicators in a serial program? But we don't think these are major problems and can be dealt with, but these are some issues. So starting from the observation we had, given that the unlocked program points are thread consistent, the boundaries of the outermost critical sections are really those thread consistent points. So the first property that the system has is, or we provide you the first property that outermost critical sections are failure atomic. And meaning that if after a crash you see any update made within an OCS, outermost critical section, in non-volatile memory, then the system guarantees you that you will see all the updates. And in this example, you'll see an inner critical section and some outermost critical sections. Now it turns out that, got garbled a bit, but it's okay. It turns out that these OCSs can have dependencies among them. And it also turns out that some of these dependencies can occur even for OCSs that are not yet complete. And what this means is that if that happens, even an OCS which has completed may have to be undone if another OCS that it depends on fails to complete for some reason. Let's take a look at an example to understand why or how this can happen. Let's say X and Y are persistent locations and initialized to zero. The two threads, T2 enters a critical section, then it acquires another lock, L1, writes to X, exits the inner critical section, and continues. So at this point, it's still within an outermost critical section. T1 starts up, acquires a lock, L1, reads X into Y, and exits the critical section. So at this point, we have an OCS O1 in T1, an inner critical section in T2, and an OCS O2 in T2. So the question is, if the program crashes, which of the OCSs can be made durable and so on? Now clearly, leading from our first property that we are providing failure atomicity at the OCS level, since O2 hasn't completed yet, its effects cannot be made durable. So O2 cannot be made durable. Now, the question is, can O1 be made durable? And the answer is no, because if you do so, then you are going to end up with an inconsistent state. And this really happens because there is a happens-before relationship between the release of lock L1 in O2 and an acquire of that lock in O1. And this leads to happens-before dependencies at the OCS level. So the second property a system has is something that essentially gives you a partial order in which OCSs can be made durable in non-volatile memory. And in this example, what happens is, said in another way, the property that you get is, if after a crash, if you see any effects of O1 in durable memory, then you better see all the effects of O2 as well. An interesting property of happens-before relationship at the OCS level is that these may actually be cyclic. And this is interesting because if you consider happens-before at the level of synchronization operations, they are always acyclic. And this can happen in our case if you have inner critical sections within OCSs that depend on each other. So in this example, as you'll see, that we have inner critical sections in both the threads, and the critical section in T1 shown in green in T1 depends on the critical section shown in green in T2, and similarly the other way for the blue critical section. And that gives you the cycle at the OCS level. And this implies that if this occurs and the program crashes, then you want to make sure that after recovery, if you see any of the effects of the OCSs in a cycle, then you should see all the effects. So basically, all the effects of the OCSs involved in a cycle must be seen together, must happen failure atomically together. So quick overview of the implementation. All of this is done dynamically. All lock operations and stores to durable memory are tracked in logs. It happens before relationship at the OCS levels are also captured. The logs are maintained in non-volatile memory so that if there is a crash, the recovery process has access to the logs and can bring the inconsistent state to a consistent state. And as the program executes, as consistent states are found, unnecessary log entries are periodically pruned. We have some optimizations, but I'm not going to get into them here. I should call out that if you remember the architectural mental model of the architecture that I showed earlier, there are still caches, and there are other volatile structures, even though we have non-volatile memory. So from time to time, you need to make sure that you flush out cache lines to non-volatile memory. And it turns out this is quite expensive, at least today. And I'll show some numbers there. So some results. If you take an NVRAM-based system, a program, and compare it with what you get today from disks, there are 2 to 3 orders of magnitude performance difference. And that's to be expected because of the huge latency difference. But the interesting question for this talk is, if you consider an existing program which doesn't have any durability, and you add durability using this model, what's the overhead? So to understand this, we took two programs. One is a deduplication kernel from the Parsec benchmark suite. And what this has is it takes in an input stream and breaks it up into chunks and maintains a hash table of key value pairs so that it's able to deduplicate. So that's a transient data structure today. Memcached also has a transient cache, and is, as you know, a widely used caching system in cloud environments. So we took the transient hash tables and caches and the accessory data structures and so on and made them durable using our model. And we wanted to look at what kind of slowdowns we get. The baseline is the transient version. We have the NVRAM version, which is the persistent version, using our model. And to understand the cost of cache line flushes, we also have NVRAM NF, where we basically remove the cache line flushes. So you'll see that the slowdowns are in the range of 30% to 160%. And I should point out that these are quite preliminary results. The software, we keep on optimizing them and finding new opportunities. And we believe that over time, many of the hardware support, the cache line flushes and so on, will get better and better and evolve over time. So we think the performance will improve. So to understand the complexity of some of the kind of the caches and the durability that we got, we measured the total number of outermost critical sections for both these applications. For dedupe, it's over a quarter million, and for memcached, it's around 4 million. If you look at the number of stores to durable memory, that's the next column, and the total number of log entries are in millions for both the programs. So basically, the takeaway is that durability is not free, and it tends to depend on how much data you're persisting. But if you use this model where your in-memory objects are durable as the program executes, there's quite a bit of opportunity to be had. But we also have to keep an eye on the overheads. So to conclude, we give you some semantics whereby you can identify program-wide consistent states at intermediate points in the program. And NVRAM makes all of this implementable in an efficient manner. Thank you. Right. So we have kind of constraints similar to what transactional memory has. The main, we haven't solved all of the problems there, but the main requirement is I/O has to be deferable, and then we believe we can handle most patterns, but probably not all. And this is still work in progress. Good question. Yes. We do, you're talking about serial code, for example, where because you know it's not, well, it looks shared, but it's really not shared, so you are not acquiring any logs. Is that the scenario you're talking about?
Right, exactly.
Yeah, so we have, we don't talk about this in the paper, but we have some notions of just durable sections, which gives you basically ACD semantics, no isolation, and you can implement all of this in the same model. And they're slightly faster, as you'd expect. That there was another question? Yeah.
Well, this looks very similar to that protocol from Checkpoint, specifically the communication that you use once.
Yeah.
I mean, I did get a good idea of your actual protocol, but is there a relationship or is it?
Yeah, we think there's a relationship. You're talking about distributed consistency, right? Yeah, so I think there is a relationship. We haven't looked into it in great detail because this is in a different context and you have to deal with locking and unlocking and arbitrary nesting and all that. But given that, at a very high level, I think we're essentially dealing with a similar problem. Yeah.
So you might add that one difference, you think, right, is that the possibility of cyclicity.
That's true, yes.
So that's different.
So I'm afraid we'll have to take that offline. Let's thank the speaker again.